This is Tape 7, Side B of the Open University course English 102, Composition and Native Indian Literature 1. On this tape, course author Patty Hartford talks to Jordan Wheeler, the author of The Seventh Wave. This interview was recorded at the Open Learning Agency in Burnaby on February 19, 1993. Jordan Wheeler is on location doing television production in Bragg Creek, Alberta, which is just outside of Calgary. And Patty Hartford is at her home in Kamloops.
So, I'm really curious. Danny Petroni has all kinds of wonderful things to say about you and that you were some sort of child prodigy who started publishing at age 17. I'm interested to know what prompted this great interest in writing for you.
It was something I was always good at in school. My favorite two subjects were English and geography, and I was more of a map freak than anything, but English, you know, writing the essay was something that came easily, writing the history essay and stuff like that. And it sort of went in tandem with Aboriginal people, Aboriginal issues. My book reports, I went to a private school, and we were given the choice of what books to do book reports on. I picked Custer Died for Your Sins and Bury My Heart, I Wounded Knee, and stuff like that. And I wrote one essay in grade 12, an argumentative essay about assimilation, and based on that, a copy of it was given to a Native magazine in Winnipeg, and they asked me to do a column for them. It was, writing is an escape. I started writing poetry in grade 5 in my spare time, and I always started stories here and there, and it was just something, you know, to escape the real world.
Did you find that initially people didn't take you too seriously?
I think so. Mainly because of my age, but also because my mother was a writer, and they thought it was just I was, you know, just there because my mother was there, and it took a few years to sort of break out of that.
I think you have. Do you write about things that happen to you personally?
It's a mix. You know, when you go for the inner sanctuary of a character's mind, I'll generally draw my own thought process. I'll draw my own feelings when it comes to the actual plot points. I'll look at my experiences and then adapt it to the character that I've created. I'll fictionalize it. I'll use, you know, four or five people that I know and combine their voices into a single character. I'll write about, you know, I write about Winnipeg. Most of my stories take place in Winnipeg or Saskatchewan, West Coast, you know, Vancouver Island, where I was born in Victoria. I used to spend a lot of time out in Tofino and Long Beach when I was a little kid. So places and, you know, the nuances that you need to create a world and a story, I'll draw my experiences and stuff like that.
Do you think that there is a most important thing for Native people to write about?
A single most important thing, it'd be really hard to approach it that way. I think for Native writers, just, you know, write what they know. Write, fictionalize their own stories. I think that's the most important thing. Because there are, mainstream stories depend on conflict, depend on drama, and, you know, and struggle. And my God, we wrote the book on that one.
What's your feeling about non-Native writers writing fiction about Native people?
That's an issue that reared its head about 4 or 5 years ago, I guess. Appropriation. It's a dicey issue. On one hand, you have the right of the writer to write whatever he or she wants, but on the other hand, if a writer chooses to write about people from another culture, then if they choose to do that, they also have to accept the responsibility to do it sensitively, to do it well, to do it accurately. Unfortunately, 99 times out of 100, they don't. They make things up. Writers base entire novels on what they hear while they're driving a cab, kind of thing. A mile in our moccasins doesn't do it. You know, it takes more than that. Nobody can stop it. and I don't think it should be stopped, but the stories that non-Native writers come up with about Native people, if they haven't taken the time and the effort and don't have the sensitivity, there's a lot of bullshit. And the bad effect is that, you know, it does a lot of damage if it makes it to television, if it makes it to print, stereotypes and misconceptions, you know, are carried on.
Okay. Who are your own favorite writers?
There's several. I think my favorite writer in the world is Tom Robbins. Not Harold, but Tom. He wrote Skinny Legs and All, Still Life with Whitbecker, Jitterbug Perfume, Even Cowgirls Get the Blues, and Another Roadside Attraction. He's sort of a very humorous writer, very witty. His humor, I think, drives his stories, and there's an unbelievability in his work, but you forgive that because it's just so darn entertaining. You know, sort of the Kurt Vonnegut kind of mold. I also like John Irving. I like Murray Campbell's stuff, Thomas King's, Thompson Highways, Lee Marico.
Many of whom we've just talked to this week. What do you think is your own best work?
My own?
Mm-hmm.
There's three that I think that are my best. One is a children's story called The Mountain Legend, which is it's published in 1985, I think, by Fifth House in an anthology called Edgemuna that Maria Campbell put together. I think that's my most successful story. And I tell it orally, and I used to do it a lot in schools, like all over the country. And it's a half-hour oral presentation. I used to have a lot of fun with it. Another story I think that is pretty good is the third story in Brothers in Arms called Exposure, which deals with every story in that book. It's three novellas, deals with two brothers, and this one of them is dying of AIDS, and he wants to die at home on the reserve in Saskatchewan, as they're both living, one's in Toronto, one's in Vancouver, and it's them going home and having to, you know, the one brother having to cope with the fact that A, his brother's dying, and B, that his brother's gay, and it takes him a long time to realize which one is more important, and then just the homophobia they're up against on the reserve. And those, I think, are my two best stories, although I really like The Seventh Wave. It's sort of a story from a different vein, though, as Thomas King put it in the introduction.
I'm going to talk to you about that introduction later. What kind of things do people say about your work lately? I mean, I know that Penny Petroni thinks you're wonderful. What are other people saying?
About my work?
Yeah.
I don't really hear too much, you know. I don't really pay attention too much. I think right now that I'm on North of 60 and all that stuff, I don't get so much feedback on the work. It's the feedback I'm getting is my profile is getting better. I'm getting more work. My name is getting more well known. In some respects, it's, you know, not so much the talent as just the presence. And I guess you need the talent to have the presence, but the response I'm getting, and not a lot of it has to do specifically with the work, is just, great, you made it this far, see if you can make it that far now. It's kind of weird.
Well, we'd love to have you read a passage, a page or two from The Seventh Wave, just whatever you'd like to read.
Sure. Right now?
Sure.
Okay. This is from the middle of the story, or not the middle of the story, but it's a couple of pages into the story. They're standing on the beach, I guess. Lynn Lake is talking. "He said he'd surf if the sun broke," she told him. She reached for the boards. Jerry looked up and cursed the sun. The sun smiled. Mike moved in and assumed authority. Jerry was a novice, so he should try body surfing first. "Whose body do I surf on?" Jerry asked. They laughed, and he decided to keep his mouth shut. He donned the wetsuit and followed Mike toward the water, watching the waves break toward shore. From a distance, it looked safe enough, almost pretty. His feet hit the water, and he leapt into the air. Ice. "The bodysuit will keep you warm," Mike assured him. At waist level, Jerry forgot what warm was. Maybe when his first layer of skin numbed up, he'd be all right. Maybe if he pissed on a wetsuit, he'd be all right. Small waves hit him. Jerry was surprised at their force. He turned and faced the beach where Lynn stood with a Nikon camera. A large wave knocked him off his feet. The salt stung his eyes. He stood up and followed Mike with a waddle induced by numbness and five beer. They started to swim. The waves were relentless. Jerry felt like a hunk of driftwood. How much further? He yelled. Mike pointed to where the waves were breaking. Past there. Jerry started getting nervous. He was in the Pacific, a mass of water 16 times the size of Canada. He might wash ashore in Okinawa. Give me mosquitoes, he thought. Bullflies. Something to swipe at. The sea foamed and swallowed. Salt and sand grazed his teeth. He surfaced, and there was calm. They come in groups of seven, Mike told them. Like dwarfs, Jerry thought, or 11s in big gulps. Seagulls flew overhead, ocean buzzards. A new group of seven began. Mike and Jerry bobbed and swayed like discarded pop bottles at the sea's mercy. If there were messages in the bottles, Jerry's would read five beer too many. Get ready, Mike yelled. Jerry copied Mike and began swimming toward shore. The water level dropped and Mike accelerated. Jerry followed. From behind, a wave caught them. Jerry felt his body rise as Mike slid down the wave's face. The wave curled with Jerry in it, tons of water crushing in on itself. It drove him face first into the sand, then twisted and flooded him about. 10 seconds later, the sea released him. Jerry tried to stand, but his head hit the bottom. He flipped and shot up into the sun, gasping for breath. His forehead was scraped from his hairline to his nose. Mike swam over. Some fun, eh? What happened to your forehead? A shark bit me, Jerry said, and he headed for shore.
That's great. Now, is this personal experience?
It's a bit of both. I lived off my early childhood. My earliest childhood memories go back to Port Alberni, B.C. I was born in Victoria, and my dad used to do a lot of things, but he had a fishing boat in Tofino, so we used to spend a lot of times up in Tofino and Long Beach. And in 1982-83, I joined Canada World Youth, a youth exchange program, and I spent 3.5 months in Alberta, St. Paul, Alberta, and 3.5 months in central Sulawesi, Indonesia. And on the way back home, we kind of took a tour of the country, and we wound up in Bali for a few days. And even in the community we stayed at, it was right on the Philippine Sea, I think it was, right on, 1 degree north of the equator and a 1 kilometer long white sand beach, concave, and we had waves. And I learned how to body surf, and then in Bali, Kuta Beach is a big, big surfing spot for the Australians, and we just carried on down there body surfing and all that. It's a lot of fun.
Sounds warm and wonderful.
It was very warm.
I know we talked about this just slightly, but the number seven has some significance for many Native writers, particularly the idea that the future for Native people hinges upon the seventh generation of Natives since the Royal Proclamation of 1763 or some other point anyway, but we often hear about seven generations. Does the fact that Jerry successfully rides the seventh wave have any additional metaphorical meaning, or is this just a numerical fact of surfing?
It's not so much a fact of surfing. I didn't realize the connection until I saw the question sheet that you sent me. It wasn't something I consciously set out to do, but in retrospect, I suppose it was subliminal. I've had this experience with critics in the past where I'll write a story and I'll think it's about this, and then I'll read what the critics have to say and I'll think, gee, I'm pretty good. I didn't even think of that. I think it's more of a subliminal thing. And I think, when you talk about what Native people should or want to write about, if you just go for the story, the themes that you want to write about, because you never set out to write about a theme, you have to come up with a story to write. But the themes will emerge anyway, because they're in you. You have those emotions. You have those ideas, those philosophies. And those ideas and those connections, I think, will surface on their own. And I think that's what happened with the seventh wave.
Well, it happened very well. In the introduction to All My Relations, Thomas King suggests that the seventh wave is a story that doesn't deal with Native issues to any extent. Do you agree?
Yes and no. It's a story about somebody who happens to be Native, and I took Jerry, away from the reserve. I took him away from the Native community, and I put him in with a bunch of old teenagers on the West Coast on a beach, and the whole idea was just, let's get a prairie guy and teach him how to surf. get a Cree Indian from the prairies and teach him how to surf and see what happens. I didn't want to tackle a huge issue. At one point, I think my attitude at the time I was writing the story comes out when Jerry gets stoned with Mike and they're out in the waves, and Mike and Jerry, just his tongue starts rolling about issues, and later on when he's, you know, back to normal, Mike wants to follow it up and Jerry says, nah, I don't want to get into it. And that at the time, I think that was my feeling too. Just it's so difficult to articulate properly the issues that affect Native people so that non-Native people can get a clear understanding, and it's frustrating when they don't understand, no matter how hard you try to articulate, you know, and it's all, you know, nuances that people don't pick up on. And so that story sort of follows that track of thinking. It's just too damn hard to articulate any issues. So I just articulated how hard it was to articulate the issues, and that's the only time I touched on any kind of issues at all. And the rest of it was just having fun with this character and the situation I put him in.
Okay. Oh, you've talked just a little bit about your work on North of 60. Would you like to talk a little bit more about what you do there?
What I do here?
Mm-hmm.
I'm a story editor and a writer. In a television series, I've been told anyway, the television series depends on the story department to come up with the scripts. Some outside writers, but you wind up, you know, rewriting most of what they write. We had to produce 16 episodes this year between the three story editors in the department and the two producers who created the series. And it's a lot of hard work. It takes a long time to, A, find out what the producers want, and B, to come up with, you know, to settle into the voice of the characters, how the characters speak, how the characters act, to really become familiar with the world in this show. It's a separate world. This is Lynx River Northwest Territory. It's a Dene community, a slavey community. And you have to encompass it all and capture it in a 60-page script that will go through numerous rewrites. And it's a lot of hard work, a lot of gratifying work. It's neat to, you know, work on something and then a few months later you see it on the television. It's been a lot of fun.
Do you find that your work is very much involved with sort of being a cultural advisor as well as a writer, or?
To an extent. I mean, cultural advisor, no, I don't think in this case, because I'm Cree, I'm not Dene. We have Dene cultural advisors. You know, the Cree and Dene have about as much in common as the French and English, and look how much they fight. So we have real cultural advisors who are people from the North, Nick Sivistin, Eleanor Brand, Leo Norwegian, Bertha Norwegian, and then all the RCMP connections we have. But what I can bring is a lot of ideas, values, and philosophies are generic to Aboriginal people. We share, you know, from nation to nation, we share a lot of the same views. So I might not know the specifics of Dene life, but in an overview of, you know, how different character in the show, how one Native character in the show will react to a situation differently from a non-Native character, I can, you know, I can say, well, wait a minute, that doesn't work. You know, that isn't right. Also, another thing I brought to the show, I think, is that I've worked in and around the Aboriginal writing communities, theater communities, for a lot of years, and so I had a lot of names, I knew a lot of people, and some of the actors that are in the show were, you know, people that, names that I'd given to the producers.
Hmm. That's gratifying.
Mm-hmm.
Is some of that humor yours too?
Some of it. You know, one of the criticisms of the show has been it was too dark and too bleak. But I think that was a knee-jerk reaction by mainstream critics because it was so different, and it's not downtown Toronto. It's, you know, there's no cappuccino bars in town, and they think that, my God, that's like you know, way out in the bush. And that's exactly where we are. There's a different humor. It was finding the voices. That was the first step, and that took, you know, six, seven episodes. Now we're starting to find humor in the voices as well. So it takes a while. It's an organic process, I think, in that regard. Some of the humor is mine, but it's also also the other writers, and even the characters bring stuff to it. That's one thing, actually, going back to the question from before, I've heard that I have a particular style of humor that I don't always utilize in my writing, but I did in The Seventh Wave, and I think one of the episodes, the episode that I wrote, episode 11, I think it's in there as well. Kind of a low-key, dry kind of humor. Mm. Not a belly-gut laugh, but more of an ironic chuckle.
Well, I certainly enjoyed it as I read Seventh Wave, and I hope students do as they read it, too. I really appreciate talking to you. It's been great.
No problem. Thanks a lot. It was fun.
Appreciate your taking the time off work and everything else. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.